Well, the epic story that we're looking at today centers on names. And as I was preparing for this sermon, as I was preparing for this message, as I was kind of studying and looking at things, ultimately I kept going down memory lane with my own family. I want to show you my family. This is my wife, Lauren, and my two kids, Andrew and Ellie. Andrew is 4 now. It's kind of hard to imagine him having any other name, but 4 years ago, Andrew wasn't Andrew. When Andrew was still in the womb, we called him Nugget because that was like our placeholder as we tried to figure out what we wanted to name him. And if you are a parent, you remember this process and the pressure that came with the process of trying to pick out a name for your kid, because names are important, and whatever you named them, they're pretty much stuck with, you know? And so Lauren and I felt that pressure. I'm sure you did too. And my guess is you asked the same basic kind of questions that we asked. You probably first started thinking through things like, do we name him after one of our family members? But what if we don't like the names of our family members? Can I name him after one side of the family and not the other side? Is that even possible? And once you start thinking through all like the little responsibilities that come with names, then you might consider other considerations. You know, my history as a youth pastor, this definitely came to my mind. Hey, is there any way to make fun of this name? If I give my son this name, is he going to survive middle school? You know, that kind of thing. You know, everyone, whether or not you have kids, whether or not you're a parent, we've all agonized over naming something before. And maybe it was a pet. Maybe you wanted to know, like, should I give him a human name to be ironic, or should I go with something classic? Or maybe it was like a username for Instagram or Twitter. You know, what are people going to see if one of my posts goes viral? Maybe it's a handle for a video game. What are those noobs going to be yelling when they throw their controllers at the screen? I don't know what it was for you, but we've all agonized over naming things because names are important. They carry meaning. And so for some of you, you wanted pretty names because beauty is important to you. For others of you, you wanted funny names because humor is important to you. But no matter what your preference, we've all taken naming things seriously before because names are important. They carry their own meaning. And what Lauren and I landed on is we decided that names we gave our kids, we wanted those names to connect them with something. And so my son's full name is Andrew David Johnson. The Andrew comes from the main character of my favorite book, which is a story about courage and sacrifice. Those are two words I hope describe his life. And the David comes from David Allgaier, who is my former youth pastor and my current mentor, friend, and boss. And when we gave Andrew that name, it was our goal, it was our hope that his name would help guide the development of his faith, the development of his character. I mean, in a way, we're hoping that Andrew will be his name. And then Ellie, my little squish, Ellie, her full name is Rachel Elizabeth Johnson. She's named after her two aunts. And it's our hope, man, that if she turns out like them, my sister and Lauren's sister, they are good, gracious, strong, funny women. And if Ellie can become like either one of them, then the world around Ellie will be blessed. When Lauren and I gave our kids their names, what we're hoping for is that their names would guide them, that their names, in a sense, would tell them who they are and who they should be. I say all that because today's story focuses on names. And in this story, God names his kids. In this story, the Israelites, the people of God, they receive their name. And God gives this name to guide them, to show them who they are and who they should be. Well, actually, that's the second thing that God does in the story. The first thing that God does in the story is he jumps somebody and roughs them up a little bit. It's a weird story. Are y'all ready? Genesis 32, that's where we're going. Genesis 32, if you have your own Bible, go ahead. You can dig in on your own or catch up with us. Otherwise, there will be verses on the screen that will follow along with what I'm talking about. But Genesis 32 is a story that focuses on a man named Jacob. Jacob's name is important, not only for the reasons that all the different things I've already said, but especially because of when this occurs. All of the events in the Bible happen in the context of an ancient Near Eastern culture. And in that culture, names were more than just tools to distinguish between one person and another person. Names carried meaning, strong meaning. Names were supposed to kind of communicate someone's character, even predict their destiny. And with that in mind, Jacob's name was not a blessing. Jacob was the second born of two boys, twin boys. He was the second born in a culture that puts a lot of emphasis on being the firstborn son. So as a twin, second born, he came into this world, and when he did, he actually had his older brother Esau by the heel. He was holding on to his foot. And so they named him Jacob, which means heel catcher. But that's another way of saying supplanter, scoundrel, con man. He's holding on to his brother's heel as if he was trying to hold his brother back, as if he was trying to take his brother's place. And so they name him Jacob the con man. And Jacob grows up and he lives out his name. He spends his life, he's got this rivalry with his older brother. What happened in the womb just continued into life. And Jacob uses all of his wits and all of his cunning to take everything from his older brother he could possibly take. He manipulates his older brother. He ends up taking his birthright, and then he actually goes to their father and he lies to their father, their old half-blind father. Jacob lies to his face to take a blessing from his father that should have been for Esau. And after Jacob has done all these things and stolen as much as he could, he ran away. He ran away from his home and he ended up going to stay with his uncle Laban, who he proceeds to con out of most of his belongings. The Bible doesn't necessarily specifically say that he conned him out of everything, but after 10 years, Jacob has most of his uncle's flocks. He has married two of his uncle's daughters, and he runs away in the middle of the night. So, you know, interpret that how you will. It's not a good situation. But Jacob runs away from his uncle, and he actually starts heading back with all of his new flocks, his herds, his family, his belonging, his servants. He heads back towards where he came from originally. He goes back home, and he does that because God has told him that that's where he should go. That's where we pick things up in Genesis 32. But before we even read this first verse, you remember that in this moment, Jacob is in a very tough place. He has fled his uncle's country because it is very tense there. And the place he's going back to, the last thing he experienced was his brother threatening to kill him. He's afraid, but he's trying to trust God. And God has told him to go home, and so Jacob is going home. Chapter 32, verse 1, Jacob went on his way home. And the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Now the word here in Hebrew that's translated camp is also translated other places in the Old Testament. It's translated as army. So there's a certain picture here that's trying to be painted. God has not sent a few angels to meet Jacob. God has sent a war host. Jacob has trusted God. He's heading home even though he's scared, and God has shown up. He's shown up in power. And as Jacob's going home, he's met by a host of angels, and when Jacob sees that, he names the place Mahanaim, two camps, my family and the army of God together. And so Jacob is encouraged, he's feeling good, and so he sends messengers to his brother Esau. He sends messengers to say, "I am coming home." And in verse 6, the messengers return to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and camels into two camps. How many camps? Two camps, thinking, if Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. Jacob is standing on ground that he has named Mahanaim, two camps, in celebration of the fact that God is with him. He has sent an army of angels to be with him. That is where he is. But when the messengers return and tell him that his brother Esau has gathered 400 guys, which is nothing compared to an army of angels, He forgets about the second camp that is the army of God and only starts worrying about his own second camp. Jacob is blinded by fear. He forgets the fact that God is with him, and he makes his own two camps, his own Mahanaim. And he splits things up as a way for someone to get away if Esau comes and destroys one camp. So Jacob separates it all out. But separating it all out doesn't make him any less scared, any less afraid. So the next thing that Jacob does is he prays. His fear drives him on his knees before God. And in verse 9, he said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me and the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for their multitude. That's good. That's awesome. Jacob has returned to a place of trust. He's prayed to God and he's reminded himself that God kept his promises to his father and he's kept his promises to his father's father. And so now Jacob is in a place where he's reminding himself that he can trust that God will keep his promises to him. It's good. Except that the very next thing that Jacob does is try to manipulate his brother Esau again. It's the next thing he does. He takes the camp that he's a part of and he breaks it into little groups. He starts separating out the herds. He separates out the camels and the servants and the money and all these different things. And he starts sending those things one at a time to his brother Esau as gifts, as presents. To say, hey, look, here's a whole herd of goats for you. Hey, camels, you like camels? Here are some camels. Here's some money. Here's some new servants. Hey, have you met my wife and kids? Because if you kill me, they'll be without a husband and without a father, right? He sends all of these things one at a time to Esau. And his plan is to come as the last one. To be the very last one in hopes that by the time he gets there, all of these elaborate gifts will have bought his brother's mercy. That's his goal. But come on. If Jacob trusted God, he wouldn't have been at the tail end of that procession. He would have been at the head. He's wrestling back and forth. He's bouncing back and forth between trust and fear, trust and fear. He breaks his group into all these little processions, these little gifts, and he starts sending them one at a time. And after he sent everybody, Jacob is left alone. Verse 24 of chapter 32, Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day has broken. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Now, who is this man? Well, it could be an angel. Many scholars actually believe that this is an Old Testament appearance of Jesus, that this is Jesus wrestling with Jacob. But whoever this is, whatever this is, it's a representative of God. So let's pause for a second. And just appreciate how weird this is. This is weird. Man, Jacob is scared and alone. He is overwhelmed and stressed out. And God's response to that is to come charging out of the darkness to attack him. He's wrestling with God in the midst of all this pain and fear. This is God's response. That is strange. But it becomes less strange when you realize that Jacob has been wrestling with God in a sense this whole time. He's been bouncing between fear and trust, between reminding himself that God is in charge, to running out to make his own plans. Jacob's been bouncing back and forth between this. He's been wrestling with God spiritually before it ever became something that happened physically. In a way, the craziest thing about this is not that God has shown up to actually wrestle with Jacob, although that's hard to get past. But the craziest thing about this is why God has shown up to wrestle Jacob. Because God is not there out of wrath. He has not shown up to wrestle Jacob to punish him for flip-flopping between trust and fear. That's not why God's there. God has personally shown up to make sure that Jacob wins this fight for faith. That's why God has come, to make sure that Jacob actually wins, that he comes out on the right side of this wrestling match with God. Many of us have found ourselves in the place where Jacob is, this place of wrestling back and forth between trust and fear, this place of between doubt and believing in God. We've wrestled in this place, and when we've wrestled in this place before, many of us have felt guilt. We've been ashamed. We've thought to ourselves, why can't we just believe? Why can't we just obey? Why is there such a fight going on inside of myself over this? And many of the times we respond to that feeling guilty, but this story should be encouraging to you. Because this story shows that God, he's not disappointed when we have to fight for our faith. And I can show it in what happens next. What happens next is, they've been wrestling all night. And Jacob probably suspects who he's fighting against, but he's not sure until whoever he's fighting against, all he does is just touch his hip and the whole thing goes out of socket. Imagine the force that would actually require. And it just happens at a touch. And when that happens, not only is Jacob suddenly in a lot of pain, he suddenly has an eye-opening moment of who he is fighting against. He has lost, but he refuses to let go. And in that moment, God says, "What is your name?" Now, in this moment, God has not suddenly realized, oops, I may have the wrong guy. That is not what's happening here, right? God is God. He knows exactly who Jacob is. He knows it. So something else is happening here. There's something else about this question. Remember the power of names, the meaning of names, especially in connection to Jacob. Because Jacob is named con man. But it's more than a name. Jacob is a con man. He is a supplanter. He is a scoundrel. He's spent most of his life taking from others what rightfully belonged to them. That is who he is, and he knows it. In fact, the whole reason that he's there alone and afraid is he's scared that his past has finally caught up to him. He's afraid that Esau, his past, is finally going to catch up to him and he's going to receive the punishment that he deserves. That's why he's there alone and afraid in the first place. And so when God pins him down and says, "What is your name?" He's not asking to make sure that who he's fighting is supposed to be fighting. He's saying, "Jacob, confess. Confess. Confess who you are. Confess what you have done." So God says, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob. My name is scoundrel. My name is supplanter. My name is con man, and it's more than just my name. It's who I am." You can almost imagine Jacob whispering this answer, maybe through tears, as he imagines that he's about to receive the punishment that he deserves. But God has not come to fight against Jacob. God has come to fight for Jacob. And in this moment of Jacob's greatest vulnerability, because God has pinned him down, he has lost, he is laid bare before God. And in this moment of vulnerability, God does not give him justice. He gives him grace. And he takes his old name, and he gives him a new one. He takes his old name, and he takes his old identity, and he gives him a new name, a new identity, and a new destiny. He gives him a new name to guide Jacob, to show Jacob who he is and who he should be. And that name not only applies to Jacob, but then it gets passed down to Jacob's kids and his kids' kids until ultimately it's the name of the entire people of God. This name that God gives Jacob is as much for you and I as it was for him. God looks at Jacob. He says, "What is your name?" And Jacob responds, "My name is Jacob." And then God says this in verse 28. He said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. The name Israel means he who strives with God, he who wrestles with God. If you stretch that out to how it would apply to the people of God, it's they who strive with God, they who wrestle with God. And this name is not given as condemnation. This is not God showing up and saying, "How dare you doubt me? How dare you have doubts? How dare you have fears when I'm here? How dare you?" No, it's not condemnation. It's freedom. God's looking at Jacob and saying, "This is who you are. You are a fighter. That is who you are. And that is what my people will be. They will fight." Then you look at the story of Jacob and it shows us that faith is a fight. It's what it is. Maybe not every single day, but faith is a fight. All of us will wrestle. All of us will fight. All of us will wrestle between fear and trust, between doubt and belief. That is not uncommon. It is the experience of faith. We want it to come naturally. We wish it came easily, but that's not how it works. But the thing about this is God has given us this name. He gave it to Jacob and he gave it to his people to show in part that God is not disappointed by that and we shouldn't be either. But really this, if anything, the people that struggle with this maybe more than anybody else is actually people who have been followers of Jesus for a long time. People who have been believers for a long time have this temptation to feel like, man, I should be past this. I shouldn't be struggling with fear anymore. I shouldn't be struggling with doubt anymore. I've been a follower of Jesus for a long time. I've seen him do great things. I shouldn't even be struggling like this anymore. But the reality is that even a committed, longtime follower of Jesus can still be caught off guard by the circumstances of life. There's a man in Effingham named Ralph. And the first thing that you notice about Ralph when you meet him is that he is a passionate man. He is a passionate man. Ralph is passionate about hunting. I once saw him meet one of our international missionaries that was visiting the Effingham campus. And in talking to him about his passion for hunting, he actually lifted that international missionary's arm to demonstrate on him where one would have to shoot a deer to sever its spine so it would just drop right there. The look on the international missionary's face, I can tell you, was priceless. But Ralph was passionate about hunting. He wanted to share that passion with others. Ralph is passionate about his faith. He is passionate about his faith, man. I taught at Effingham last week. At the end of the message, Ralph came up to me. He said, "Good brother, you said the name of Jesus 50 times. That is a JPM, a Jesus per minute of 1.7. That's my new record. I think I can beat it, though. I think with some training, I can beat it." Ralph is passionate about his family, which is what made the last 6 months particularly difficult for him. Because it was about 6 months ago that he got a phone call from his son Ross that began with, "Dad, I have some bad news." And from that moment for the next 6 months, I watched Ralph wrestle God. No one that has ever met Ralph would doubt his faith or his commitment to Jesus. But when he heard the news that his son had been diagnosed with liver cancer, that began a fight for faith. Ralph cried every day for 6 months. He would cry himself to sleep at night, and then he'd wake up in the morning and realize it wasn't a dream, and he'd cry again. But Ralph fought, and he prayed, and he wrestled. And over time, he heard God whisper to him what God whispered to Paul: "My grace is sufficient for you, and my power is made perfect in weakness." And when Ralph reached that place, he started to find his foundation restored. He started to find his faith. That fight started to end in victory. See, Ralph learned something in that moment that every follower of Jesus must learn. when you battle with God, you only win by losing. When you're in a fight with God, you only win by losing. We could see it in Jacob, and I saw it in Ralph. He had to reach a place. He had to reach a place, even in the midst of his storm, even in the midst of his struggle, in the midst of his fight. He had to reach a place of submission. He had to get to the place where he remembered what he had known before. God is God. He is not. And that God is still good, even when life is not. Ralph had to be reminded that God owed him nothing, and that he had given Ralph 29 years with the best son a God could give a father, and that every day of that was a blessing. When Ralph got there, he prevailed, and he won his fight. He won his fight for faith. Ross is the name of Ralph's son. And when Ross heard that I was going to be talking about this today, he contacted me. I just want you to read something from the text that he sent me. Ross wants us to know, I want to make clear what my faith was based in during this time. While we prayed for healing, my faith was never that I would be healed. My faith was in the Lord, that even if I wasn't healed, he is who he says he is, and that is good. What do you hear in that? Because I hear strength. And I hear peace. I'm happy to report that as of a couple of weeks ago, Ross is cancer-free. Yeah, that's awesome. We prayed a lot for Ross out of the Effingham campus. That's awesome. Ross being cancer-free is to the glory of God, but I need you to hear this. I need you to hear this. Even if God had not intervened, even if God had not healed him, he would have been glorified through this situation. Because in the midst of that storm, two men wrestled with God. And they fought through their fear, their anger, their confusion, and their doubt. And ultimately, they submitted. And when they submitted, they land on the fact that God is sovereign and he is good and his ways are better, even if we can't see the why. And when they did that, when they submitted, they received in return a joy and a peace that did not make sense given their situation. And when people saw that, they gave glory to God. And Ross and Ralph learned the only way you win when you fight God, the only way you win is by losing. Now, all of us will be in that fight for faith eventually. Some of you are in it right now. But what that fight looks like does look different based off of the person, based off of the circumstances. I mean, some of you wouldn't even consider yourself a follower of God, but you're here because you're fighting for belief. You're wrestling with belief in the first place. Some of us are in situations like Ross, like Ralph, where a circumstance has happened that is causing you to question the goodness or the power of God. For others, it's about sin. It's about something that you've done or are doing, and you carry so much shame with that that you're struggling to believe that God could love you, that he would forgive you for what you've done. Some of you, it's about doubt. It's about just an intellectual battle with God. And no matter what is the cause of it or the circumstances of it, whether you're in it now or will be in it in the future, we all ultimately have to fight for our faith. So the question is, when we find ourselves in that fight, what do we do? Step one is, realize this is normal. It's normal. Everybody has to fight for their faith at some point. God named us, and he named us those who wrestle with God. God knew this is what it is. He called us fighters. This is not disappointing to him, and it should not be disappointing to us. Begin with that and realize the only thing that ever disappoints God in the midst of this is if we give up. So that's step one. Step two is, in the midst of the fight, pray hard and pray through. Pray hard and pray through. Pray hard. Hosea 12:4 speaks to the story about Jacob wrestling with God. And Hosea 12:4 actually says that he strove with the angel. He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. Jacob was weeping and begging his way through fighting God. Jacob wasn't proud. He was honest. And if you're angry, don't pull your punches. Tell God about your anger. If you're scared, don't minimize your fear. Tell God what you're afraid of. Be honest and pray hard and then pray through. Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't stop. Pray through the fight. Jesus told his followers that they should pray without ceasing and never give up. The picture that he gave to his disciples was that they should be like a persistent widow who went to the house of a judge and banged on his door day and night and yelled, asking him for justice. For justice. And so the idea is while you're praying through your fight, man, you've got to knock until your knuckles are bloody and you've got to yell until your voice is hoarse. Pray through. Pray and don't give up. Our weapons in this fight for faith, our weapons are prayers and tears. Those are our weapons. And if you hear that and think those weapons seem weak, remember, those are the weapons that were employed by Jesus himself. See, Jacob and Jesus were a lot alike, which shouldn't be surprising to us. Every story that we hear during the course of this series is going to remind you in some way about the life of Jesus. That's not on accident. The whole Old Testament points to Jesus. It's about Jesus. So every story that we hear about during the series will point to Jesus, including the story of Jacob. Like Jacob, Jesus was alone the night before he faced a great trial. And like Jacob, Jesus wrestled with his father and asked him, is there any other option other than the cross? Because if there's any other option, God, please give it to me. Like Jacob, Jesus wept his way through that wrestling match. The Bible says that he sweat blood with the intensity of that encounter. And like Jacob, Jesus ultimately said, your will be done. Ultimately, Jesus did submit. Well, some of you right now, you're in that fight. Right here, right now, you're in that fight. Maybe you came today thinking that you just needed something to get you through another few days, another week. You needed help in this fight. Maybe that's why you're here, but you're carrying shame. You're carrying guilt. You're carrying doubt. You're in your fight right now. I want you to know that Jesus understands. He understands because he went through his own fight. And now he is in your fight with you, not against you, with you. What I want to do is kind of following that advice to pray hard and pray through. I just want to pray for you right now. I want to pray hard for you right now. I want to pray for you. If you're someone in this room that feels like you're in the midst of a fight, I want to pray that you will not give up. And I want to pray that you would live up to the name that God has given you. He has called you a fighter, that you will live up to that. And I'm going to pray that in the midst of your fight, God will show you that he is good and worth the fight. Father, I ask first and foremost that we would be able to focus on you, who you are and how good you are. God, you respond with grace when you could respond with justice. And so much of the time, Father, when we wrestle and we doubt, when we struggle, when we have fear, you've done so much to show us that we can trust you, and yet we still find ourselves in this wrestling match. And instead of responding with justice, you've extended us grace. You call us fighters. You say that you understand it, and that you're actually here to fight for, not against us. God, you are good, and you're much better to us than we deserve. Father, I pray for any brothers and sisters in this room right now who are fighting for faith, who are facing circumstances that are making them doubt your goodness, that are struggling intellectually with things that they see in your word versus things they hear in this, from this world. They're struggling about whether or not they can believe you. They're struggling with their sin and the shame that comes with it. I pray for them right now, Father. I ask that you would be with them in this fight. And God, they came here and they want to hear something from you. They were hoping to experience you today. And so, Father, I ask that right now you would nudge them, that you would whisper to them, that you would tell them that you love them, that you are for them, and that your grace is sufficient for them, because your power is made perfect in their weakness. Father, I ask that you would help them continue to fight, and that you would continue to show up in ways that they cannot deny and they cannot miss, that you would show yourself to them in a powerful way to give them what they need to continue to fight until ultimately land on the fact that you are good and you are worth it. Father, that's what I ask in the name of Jesus, and I pray these things in his name. Amen.